I want to look at this story of the Good Samaritan tonight with you. I've come to kind of see this parable in sort of deeper ways, I think, that helped me understand some things about it that I hadn't seen for a long time. And so, first of all, I want to say that this is a parable, the Good Samaritan story, and parables are very specific kinds of stories. It seems to me that the purpose of the parables is to overturn assumptions and expectations that people have, you know, assumptions that are based on ways of seeing and thinking that sometimes we're not even aware of, you know, the fish not being aware of the water that it's in. And parables come along and they expose the assumptions that we operate with in terms of how the world works who's in and who's out, the sort of configurations of proper relationships and power and so on. And so we're operating out of these culturally construed assumptions, and the parable sort of opens this up for us, challenges it, calls them into question, and it discloses perhaps maybe an alternative way of seeing it, you know, kind of adjusts us, helps us see differently. And the Good Samaritan parable is something like that, except I think the problem is it's become too familiar, and we're not challenged anymore in terms of our way of seeing or living. It's become kind of domesticated, and so, you know, we can have the, you know, someone be a appointed Good Samaritan of the Month or something like that. And so it becomes trivialized in many ways. And so, you know, it's a very common story, and we could probably summarize it something like there's a guy traveling from Jerusalem to Jericho, and he's attacked by robbers, and he's left for dead, and then a priest and a Levite come by, and they pass by him on the opposite side. And then a Samaritan comes along and has compassion on him and attends to his wounds. He puts the guy on his donkey, takes him to an inn, gives the innkeeper some instructions along with funds to take care of this guy who's been beaten up. And then, you know, the parable sort of reduced to this simple teaching that exhorts acts of human kindness. That's really what this is all about. Should you come across someone who's in pretty rough shape, don't just pass them by, but help them out of their situation in need, even if it costs you something. Okay, let's do it. But the problem is that this is really a story about compassion. That's the term used to describe this action of the Samaritan. And the top of that sheet is a quote from Walter Brueggemann's Prophetic Imagination about compassion that I think much more gets to the core of this story. When he says, compassion constitutes a radical form of criticism, for it announces that the hurt, that is, the suffering in the society, is to be taken seriously. That hurt or suffering, pain, is not to be accepted as normal and natural, but as an abnormal and unacceptable condition for humanness. Thus, the compassion of Jesus is to be understood not simply as a personal emotional reaction, but as a public criticism in which he dares to act upon his concern against the entire numbness of his social context. Jesus penetrates the numbness by his compassion, and with his compassion takes the first step in making visible the odd abnormality that has become business as usual. Thus, compassion that might be simply seen as generous goodwill is in fact criticism of the system, forces, and ideologies that produce the hurt. That's a much more robust notion of compassion than simply to water it down to this notion of, you know, occasional human kindness. John Sobrino, who's a Salvadoran theologian, says, compassion is not something peaceable and inoffensive. The exercise of compassion is directly to defend and save victims, but indirectly, yet necessarily, it is to denounce tormentors. So compassion, I think, is not simply a personal act of kindness done by one person for another person who's in need, but it's actually a kind of critique of the arrangements of social and political forces that produce hurt and then render such hurt acceptable and normal. Compassion exposes and condemns the cultural numbness that accompanies the normalization of pain and suffering. When a society perpetuates suffering, but doesn't see that anything's wrong. So let's talk about this story from that angle. First, let me set a bit of the background, the historical background. 60 years or so before Jesus arrived on the scene, the Romans had come into that area of the world and conquered it and occupied Judea, Samaria, and the Galilee. And the Romans had a practice of setting in place, as ruling officials, some of the local aristocracy. So Herod the Great, for example, was the first king of this area, ruler of this area, and he was an Idumean from an area just east and south of Judea. Now, the task of the rulers that the Romans would appoint would be to subdue and control the population, don't let things get out of control, to extract resources for the benefit of the imperial centers, and also to collect the requisite tribute and taxes for the governance and the upkeep of the empire, but also for those who are local governors to make sure that they have the resources to carry out that task. So the local rulers would need to demonstrate loyalty to Rome, which Herod did. He used to build these monstrous monuments to various rulers in Rome and tried to show in many ways his loyalty to the empire. But they also had to show competence in controlling local population as well. So that meant a set of like a system of administration for collecting the taxes and the tribute, for enforcing, compliance. So you'd need a security force and so on. And then, of course, you'd need, like, the taxes to fund all that stuff. Powerful local institutions, of course, had to be controlled. So in order to make everyone compliant to the wishes of the Roman rulers, you had to make sure that any of the local institutions were also on board and weren't going to cause trouble. And in this part of the empire, that meant, of course, the cooperation of the religious establishment, because the temple and its activities were central to the life of this area of Judea and the Galilee, and particularly Judea, but of Jewish life in that area. So the political leadership would consist on the ground in Judea, Samaria, and in the Galilee of local aristocratic families and also key temple personnel, like high priests, for example. Herod used to appoint the high priest to make sure that the person who ran this very influential and powerful institution was on board with his political agenda. During the time of Jesus, Judea was governed by a Roman official, the procurator, Pilate, but also by temple priests. And they had a lot of power and privilege, and they maintained their status in the society because of a cooperative relationship with the occupying forces. One writer puts it this way: the temple was not only a religious and political institution, it was a major economic force, controlling massive amounts of money while continuing to accumulate more. All of its functionaries were part of this system, and they served it. The bureaucrats oversaw the temple's many functions, things like the payroll and organizing the various events around the temple. And they oversaw the temple's contracts for goods and services, and that had a huge effect on the economy of Judea. So these were people of real substance, of political, social, and economic power. But for the majority of people, things were very different. I mean, being under the imperial thumb of Rome meant, among other things, heavy taxation. Resources were extracted from the people to support three different levels of social and political administration. The Roman officials, of course, tribute had to be sent on to Rome, otherwise it's an act of rebellion. Local administrators and officials had to be paid, and also payment had to go to the ongoing operations of the temple. Now, people calculate that perhaps at this time, anywhere for many of the just like the working class, we might call them, farmers, peasants of some sort, would have to be paying, say, 40 to 70% of their income to pay off these various administrative taxes. So once these taxes have been paid, there's hardly any left for the peasant farmer and his family to survive. And if you throw into the equation crop failure, family illness, or death, drought, well, that could completely devastate a family and cause them to go into serious debt to wealthier members of the society. And of course, then failure to pay that debt would mean loss of land, debt servitude, and other desperate ways of supporting oneself and one's family, like day laborers or beggars. And, you know, it's interesting because you get stories in the Gospels that Jesus engages with day laborers and with people begging. You know, blind Bartimaeus is a blind beggar, and so on. Well, these kinds of conditions contributed to the rise in the first century of this phenomenon we might call social banditry. Now, Josephus, who's a Jewish historian of the first century, tells us in his writings that this kind of banditry was rampant in these days, the first century, and that rulers were often preoccupied with trying to keep it under control. Sociologists tell us that this kind of social banditry is the result of economic and political pressure and the widespread desperation that that kind of pressure creates. It's an indicator of economic and political stress. Social bandits arise when peasants are losing ground economically and being squeezed into increasing forms of dependency. Now, that's pretty interesting. Gives a new slant to the guys, the robbers up in the hills. I mean, this guy is on his way from Jerusalem to Jericho, and he's attacked by bandits, by these desperate people who've been so marginalized that they've resorted to lurking in the hills and attacking bypassers in order to survive. So this kind of thing is fueled by poverty, but it also might be fueled by politics. That is, the bandits were resisting the presence of foreign occupation and the ways in which their own rulers were willingly cooperating with the non-Judean masters. Well, along comes this traveler in these kind of, the road between Jerusalem and Jericho is a fairly kind of remote sort of place. And into this kind of empty space, if you like, or marginal space, we get a situation of victimization. And in context of where there's exploitation, where there's inequality or structural injustice, then there are also victims. Now, there's no reference to this guy's nationality, to his social status, to his financial situation. He's just the victim of a violent attack. We're not told that this person was worthy or unworthy of assistance, for example. He was beaten, stripped, left half dead. Now, this is he's in a problematic state. Not only physically is he in a situation of near death and in need of assistance and unable to help himself, but being physically injured and likely bleeding, he's also in a state of being ritually unclean. And this is where the priest and the Levite come on the scene. Now remember that the priest and the Levite are two characters in the parable that belong to the center of political and economic power in their society. These are the leaders of the religious establishment. They're the privileged ones. Put in power by Rome and sustained in that position through their willingness to cooperate with the ruling elite. They benefit from a political and economic arrangement of power that keeps them among the privileged, like the wealthy few, and it keeps others, like the bandits, desperately poor, trying to make a living in whatever ways they can. Now, in this particular story, the priest and the Levite pass by the wounded person at some distance, and the text goes out of its way to indicate this kind of distancing from the wounded person. Now, what, you have to think, well, why would they do that? Like, why pass by this guy? Well, perhaps they viewed him as a threat. I mean, to attend to him, to draw near and touch him, would put in jeopardy their own status within the temple administration. To touch one who is unclean would render them unclean as well, and so unfit to participate in the temple activities, or unclean to, so they would compromise their status of privilege and social standing. It would harm them in this way. So the parable discloses for us to see a kind of numbness of the religious leaders who were embedded in a social, an economic, and a political arrangement of privilege that generated social injustice and violence and human despair and immense suffering, and that caught in that system, they were numb and maybe incapable of care. And then along comes the Samaritan. Now, this guy's the hero of the story, but kind of an unlikely hero, really. I mean, Samaritans were outsiders as far as the Judeans were concerned. From their vantage point, and from the vantage point of the professional interpreters of the Torah, the official, accepted, normalized viewpoint, well, Samaritans were heretics. They were outcasts of God himself. They misread the scriptural traditions, and they followed patterns of belief and practice that violated the Torah injunctions. But this Samaritan responds to the victim in an opposite manner to that of the priest and the Levite. Maybe it was because he himself knew what it was like to be an outsider, to be disenfranchised, and that allowed him to understand and empathize with victims of an exclusionary system. They kept their distance, but he's moved with compassion and draws near. They pass by on the opposite side of the road. Well, he approaches and touches the bleeding, nearly dead man, and attends his wounds. Well, they're gone as quick as possible. He puts the person on his donkey and bandages them up and ensures the ongoing care at personal cost. So this is the thing that is, of course, very disturbing, because it turns out that the professionals, the paid staff of the religious establishment, do not keep the core commandments of the Torah. But the one who is by definition a Torah breaker fulfills the central injunction to love. I mean, it's outrageous. It's disturbing. Well, the thing about this story is that it sits within a narrative framework within the gospel. And in this framework, Jesus is talking to someone, telling him this story. And the framework is that Jesus is addressing the parable to an expert, a nomikos, a lawyer, it gets translated, but it means someone who is an expert in the matters of the Torah and of the Torah and Torah interpretation. It goes like this. Just then a lawyer stood up to test Jesus. And he said, "Teacher, what must I do to inherit eternal life?" He said to him, "Well, what's written in the law? What do you read there?" And he answered, "Well, you shall love the Lord your God with all your heart, with all your soul, with all your strength, with all your mind, and your neighbor as yourself." And he said to him, "Well, you've given the right answer. Do this and you'll live." But wanting to justify himself, he asked Jesus, "And who is my neighbor?" Now, we first have to see that the lawyer is this one who is the expert in the law, expert in the Torah. And as such, he is dependent for his livelihood on the temple and its institutional practices. I mean, his colleagues are the priest and the Levite, and he's closely connected to, maybe even dependent on, those with social privilege and status. Now, initially, there's a kind of consensus between the Torah expert and Jesus. Participating in the life of the coming age, you know, eternal life, requires keeping the commandments of Torah, and central to those commands is the injunction to love God and love your neighbor. But the professional Torah scholar wants to put himself in the right, we're told. He wants to vindicate his own understanding of the law and the practices that attend that understanding. So in Luke's comment before stating the lawyer's question to Jesus, this is what he says. He's trying to justify himself. And so comes the question, who is my neighbor? Now, it seems like this Torah exegete was looking to Jesus to define neighbor, hoping, expecting maybe, that perhaps there would be a definition that would exclude certain people from that group to be loved. You know, certainly there would be some, like Samaritans, for example, who stood outside divine acceptability and whom he could kind of cross off his list as neighbor to be loved. So in response to this question, then Jesus tells him the story of the priest, the Levite, and the Samaritan, which is a really curious response to the question, because the parable apparently doesn't seem to address the question of who is my neighbor at all. In fact, it seems to skirt that entirely. Because when the parable is finished, Jesus asks the lawyer a question. He says, which of these three do you think was a neighbor to the man who fell into the hands of the robbers? And he said, the one who showed him mercy. See, the question suggests a twist to the issue at hand. The parable was not designed, it turns out, to answer the question, who is my neighbor? But rather, what does it mean to be a neighbor? Now, this is a very interesting thing because the Greek word for neighbor is plesion. It means near one. But think of the spatial dynamics of the story. The priest and Levite passed on the other side. They were spatially far from the victim, the wounded guy. Who was the near one? The Samaritan. He's the one who drew near. And so it seems like the whole story is, what does it mean to be a neighbor? What does it mean to be near? And perhaps then, what does it mean to love? So it's a matter of being a neighbor, of showing love as a neighbor that Jesus illustrates. The Torah expert, of course, has to admit that it was the outcast and despised Samaritan who actually fulfilled the Torah and its central injunction to love, in his capacity to suffer with, to feel the pain and the hurt of the other, to have compassion in that sense, and to act for his well-being at personal cost. Well, you see, from the standpoint of the common religious assumptions of the status quo, this is absolutely disturbing. Especially to those who control acceptable social and religious perspectives and practices. Now, it seems to me that this is kind of crucial here, because, you see, if Jesus just wanted to illustrate compassion, and if compassion is really just being kind to someone who is in need, then why include the priest and the Levite in the story at all? What's the point of their presence in the story? What has been gained by them being a part of it? After all, this happened in some deserted road between Jerusalem and Jericho. Who would have seen them anyways? Well, it seems to me that their presence in the story sets up a contrast between the actions of the priest and the Levite on the one hand and the actions of the Samaritan on the other. The non-Torah practicing priest and Levite over against the Torah-adhering Samaritan, the numb and indifferent representatives of the religious establishment, and therefore the political and economic elite, versus the heretical but wonderfully compassionate Samaritan. And I think this contrast is quite intentional and purposeful. The story as told does not offer a picture of the nature of compassion and the shape of its embodiment in the world, or not only does that, it also presents a prophetic critique of social and religious indifference to human suffering. That's the point of them being in the story. See, the problem is not with this particular priest and Levite, that, you know, these guys just happen to be a couple of bad apples. You know, most priests and Levites were pretty nice people. probably they would respond in a caring way. That's not what we're getting here. We're not sort of individualizing, I think. It's not as if other priests would have acted with genuine care and compassion. The point here is what the compassion of the Samaritan exposes and what Jesus lays bare in his parable is that the religious institutions in which this priest and Levite participated and the institution that funded their elevated status has been co-opted by the dominant consciousness, by the social norms and the practices that were acceptable of their day. They had become so enculturated, so intoxicated with power and privilege, so addicted to their own entitlement that they inevitably failed to keep the essential commandment of Scripture, the command to love. From within their perspective of enjoyable social status, love of neighbor could only be actualized if such love did not endanger or jeopardize their privileged standing. Their actions of indifference supported the status quo, the structures that produced violence, and their numbness and their lack of compassion affirmed systemic injustice. Now, this is a very challenging thing, because I think what it does is it also highlights a couple things. One is it connects with Monday night's discussion of Amos. And you can see Jesus standing in the tradition of Amos, calling into question the ways in which religious establishment and their personnel often perpetuate systems of injustice and participate in them and benefit by them from them, in fact. And so don't call them into question. And the prophetic stance is one that exposes that and says, this is not right. This is not okay. I think the other thing that this challenges is that compassion is not charity. Because if we're right in reading this in this way, then compassion has that element, as Brueggemann says, of prophetic critique. It exposes ways in which a society sets up a certain level of normalcy of suffering and injustice and says it's okay. It doesn't matter that much. We can handle having homeless people out there tonight. It's okay. It's just normal. There's not much you can do about it. You just have to go with it. Okay? So we can normalize a certain amount of suffering and pain that people go through. And it's not called into question. Compassion exposes that and says, no, that's not right. We're going to call that into question. But see, the problem with charity is this. Charity never addresses structural issues. In Paulo Freire's book, Pedagogy of the Oppressed, he calls this false generosity. Charity is false generosity. Because inevitably, it's certain people with excess offering some of that excess that gets distributed to people who don't have enough. But it never addresses the structural issue. It never addresses why it is that people always have too much up here and people here always have not enough. It doesn't address that issue of equality and justice. The question of justice is not tackled within the framework of charity, but it is within the framework of this compassion, which exposes, which critiques, which opens up a way of questioning, which challenges assumptions of the status quo and the way things are organized. And I think this is very important. In reflecting on this, a couple of things, and then we can perhaps break and, I don't know, have conversation together. I think we need to, first of all, stand silent and exposed before the compassion of the Samaritan. Because let me talk about myself. Within the framework of the story, I am the priest, the Levite, and especially the Torah scholar. That's where my training was. I was trained to be, you know, a professional exegete. So that's where I am in this story. I'm caught in the story. I'm exposed as one who benefits from a system that perpetuates violence. I'm the privileged. I'm the entitled one in the society. I'm the one within the fold of, let's say, the religious establishment, the theological academy, and I know the advantages of social acceptance that can give. And to a considerable degree, you know, I've been co-opted by the system of power and privilege that benefits me, and I end up sometimes consciously, unconsciously supporting and endorsing that system, even if it produces injustice and violence, maybe even just through my silence and acceptance of it. And inevitably, what grows is a kind of indifference, a numbness, an unresponsiveness to the victims and the outcasts, who are mostly kept out of sight, on the periphery of our experience and our perceptions, you know, on some remote spot between Jerusalem and Jericho, in some remote native reserve, in some psych ward, you know, behind closed doors. That's where the suffering and the cries are heard. But I can't hear them. You know, I'm on the way to the mall, and I just can't detect that stuff. And so I just, it's not there. It's not real for me. I don't know what's happening. So this story exposes me as being in that place of privilege and in that place of numbness and all too willing to accept, let's say, normalized misery. And at the same time, I think we have a lot to learn from the socially despised and the rejected. And they can help us see how harmful maintaining the status quo is, how violent and unjust the structures of normalized social and political arrangements are. And they can help us see that breaking the bonds of our addiction, of my addiction, to social acceptance and status and entitlement, breaking those bonds means freedom to love the other, to stand with the victims, to listen and understand their pain, and to live a life of compassion. So the challenge, it seems, that it throws down is a kind of, is a large one. It's to embark on maybe this profound movement of change from being like the priest and Levite to being like the Samaritan. And maybe this movement, which is an ongoing journey of conversion, means that I need to co-locate in some ways, come to understand that perspective of and that experience of marginality, of exclusion. I think the other thing that I want to say is that the call to compassion is not just, we talked about this on Monday night, is not just to us individually. I think it's to us as a community. How can we together turn from the numbness of privilege and having too much and embody compassion in the world? I was thinking, if we said, you know, to people who are, you know, on the streets or wherever in places of pain and suffering where we hear those cries, to say, not just individually, you matter to me, but what if we said, as a community, you matter to us, or as a city, you matter to us. And if we really meant that, if we were going to take love seriously, then it's no longer acceptable to have them on the street. It's no longer acceptable to have them dumpster diving for whatever they can find. That's not acceptable. And I think this is the thing that's so challenging at the end of when Jesus asked the guy at the very end, when he says, let me get the quote exactly. Which of these three do you think was a neighbor to the man who fell into the hands of the robbers? And he said, the one who showed him mercy. And he said, go and do likewise. And I think, of course, it would be very disturbing. Imagine it. It would be very disturbing for the priest, the Levite, and the theologian here, to take seriously what Jesus said, to do as he said, to embody the parable, to act like the Samaritan, to be taught by the Samaritan how to keep the law. That would be an affront. Not only that, but I mean, think how messy it would get think what kind of changes it might start affecting. It would ripple through these institutions if priests didn't mind becoming unclean by touching like bloody victims. And then started to say, well, gosh, how come people are being beat up on this road anyways? How come people are in the hills desperately trying to survive by, you know, taking advantage and creating victims over here? Like, what's going on? Maybe they start to ask, like, what's going on here? And it could start to really unravel, you know, institutional structures that are very powerful and so on. So go and do likewise. It's not a light thing here. This is a very disturbing possibility. And so this is what the challenge of the Good Samaritan parable is for us. Because to step in and embody compassion in this way calls on us to be aware of and critical of and reimagine social structures and issues of justice. Anyways, I don't have like a great line to end on, so I'm afraid that's it. Anyways, thanks for listening.
What time is it? Oh, great. So we got lots of time. So let's take a 10-minute coffee break. There's coffee right here to the left. Let's be back here at 9 o'clock so we can give ourselves a good half hour of questions and answers. There is the introvert box up here. So if you're an introvert and you think, I've got a burning question that I want to ask, you can put it in there. And the extroverts might shut up long enough for us to actually get to the box. Okay? So cookies, coffees down there, and washroom.
And I stepped into a war zone, but I didn't even know it before I went. Like I said, I was so clued out about the world and what was going on. I didn't even know it. My mother-in-law says, oh, I hear you're going into like a war zone. No, you're still, don't be silly. There's nothing going on. Anyway, I just didn't have a clue. So what I discovered was two things. One is that I stepped into a place where there was a real struggle for justice that had a lot of historical roots and cost people lives, cost people a lot. And it rendered my own effort to develop my career during that year as being like kind of ridiculously irrelevant. And that was just kind of a real wake up. It's just a shock to my system. And it was a good shock. But I came back sort of dazed and confused and not sure where to go from there. But anyways, so I ended up, you know, teaching full time, but always mulling over a lot of this stuff, and decided I was going to get involved. So I started to volunteer in the downtown east side, and I'm not a very good volunteer. I mean, I'm an introvert. That's why I went to school, being an academic. So I didn't really network. I just wanted to hang out with people. I wanted to understand what was going on, and I wanted to just listen a lot more than, I didn't want to talk. I wanted to listen. So that started a long kind of journey of trying to understand things there. And anyways, along the way, opportunity came up to move into a community house where I lived. And then the community house, the envision was people living in the community house and having people from the street or whatever come and live together. So I guess I wanted to open up, not just do 3 hours of volunteer downtown, but I wanted to open up like some of the closest places in my life to potential friendship and potential chaos. And I wanted to understand some of that. So we lived that for 6 years. I wouldn't say we lived it very well, but we lived it. And during that time, I also decided to quit my job because it didn't make that much besides the trouble I have with the academy in general, as being really a kind of institution arm of socialization into the status quo. I also, my wife got a teaching job. She finished her degree and was teaching high school, and it just seemed kind of silly to me that be living in a community house and believing that journeying with people and being with people was important, and then we were both off working full time. It seemed kind of silly. So, besides which, we didn't need to both work. We just try to live pretty simple. So I quit and went back part time. And then the quitting was also meant to open up, trying to figure out new ways of being engaged in the community. So I felt like I could be in. I wanted to be involved a little bit more. And part of the journey for me too was that the emergence of the social and political analysis and trying to formulate ways of engaging started to take more root. I started to read more, and I participated in groups that were doing things. So I was actually. It's kind of bizarre in a way, but I actually, along with another person, we rented a storefront in the downtown East Side, and it was just there for people, local people, to have meetings, talk about things that mattered in their life, and organize and plan things. And so it was just a space for a kind of meeting and group planning things. So we were trying to in that way facilitate those kind of ventures. And then in the midst of that process, various things happened, but we ended up, some other people came and said, listen, can we use your space for an illegal safe injection site? And we said, sure. So for 6 months, we ran an illegal site in the sense that we had no permits from 10 at night till 2 in the morning. Probably 3,500 people used it over the 6 months. No overdoses. It was all peer-driven, run by a nurse or two. And I wasn't involved directly. I wasn't down there many of the nights, but I just sort of held the lease on the place. And probably if anything happened, I suppose it would have been my neck on the line. But I just thought, yeah, it was for various reasons it seemed like an important thing to do. And I think it was. We tried to make this place a place of welcome, and I think to this day a lot of people associate that place with as a site that was for the people on the street. But I bet you no one knows whose place it was. They just thought it was their place, and so it was. I was very backgrounded. Anyway, so did that for a while. And lately, have moved into another house that's more of a place for welcoming people off the street, just as neighbors, as friends. So we know most of them, and they come by for laundry, or if they need to crash overnight, or stay under our porch, or have a meal, or have a shower, I don't know, whatever. And that's just, I mean, for me, that keeps my life grounded in the stories of people's lives and in real face-to-face encounters. But I am more interested in these kind of larger structural things that continue to keep people and push more and more people onto the street and so on. And so I want to think about these larger things and figure out ways of responding to them. So I'm in the we're sort of with others in the process of trying to formulate a group that takes that as its focus, but comes out of a place of theological and social reflection, but tries to formulate maybe some responses to these structural things. And some of it's just, you know, structural things, not. Some of it takes the form of criticism. Some of it takes the form of alternatives being proposed. Some of it takes the form of trying to kick open some imagination and to rattle perhaps assumptions that we're, the culture operates by. And I think we need to shake loose some of those things that have us gripped pretty deeply. So, yeah, so I don't know. Like, it's really hard to describe what I do. I don't know most of the time what I do. Seriously. I think mostly, when I left Regent, people said, oh, you shouldn't leave because, you have a gift of teaching. And I said, so who says you have to teach in an institution? And I guess really what I'm trying to figure out is how to teach off the beaten path and get into the fray and teach in the sense of open up new ways of seeing and hear new things that awaken us to a kind of alternative social reality. So in that sense, it's not a path already laid out. It's just kind of making it up as I go, I think, mostly. Wow, you hit on a lot of things. That's good. Okay, in 2 minutes. No, I think one of the things we have to be a little bit careful of is like the good poor and the bad poor and making kind of distinctions. So, for example, of course, it always feels bad when, you hear the stats of, the millions of people with AIDS, dying with AIDS, and people dying of starvation all over the world. And that's true. And we have to look at our own complicity in that. And there can be a response. But it is, to me, disturbing that there is poverty here. And let's say people won't starve on the streets necessarily, but are they going to be included in the society? Are they going to be embraced? Does anybody ever want them around? If you're looking poor, can you go into a store in Gastown without having security, wonder what you're doing there? You know, there's a sense in which you're being, you are excluded from a society. And when we have a society that has so much affluence, and in the midst of that affluence has poverty, it's not surprising then that we're falling way behind on our commitments to international aid. I mean, would there be a correlation? I mean, if we actually see that people at home, that we're going to call our own citizens, don't matter in terms of how we distribute resources. Are we really going to think that people dying in Africa matter? So we made this commitment of 0.7% that is supposed to go to foreign aid, and we're at 0.3, and we said no, that's all we can do. So, like, I think there's a correlation between those two. So I think if we in the midst of our affluence, there's a kind of inadequate response. Like, we're happy with people having to spend their days hustling food at free meals. I just think that there's something wrong, and it's not something wrong with them. There's something wrong with us. But think of it this way. Remember the, there are little snippets that tell you that sure, there might be some good-hearted people and, organizations and agencies that provide food and shelter for people so they're not going to die or starve or whatever. Okay, that's fine. But think of the way in which there's really a lack of value for people who in a capitalist economy and a country of affluence, you happen to be poor. Like, what does that translate out in terms of, like, your value in a society? So I thought, you remember there's a guy who got kidnapped or something, and they had all these forces, like police everywhere, looking for this kidnapped guy. And apparently, his father had some wealth, and so they're thinking, well, I guess he got kidnapped to maybe
get some, you know, family money. That's what the kidnappers were after. And so there's all this like police mobilization to find this guy. So where were the police mobilizing for the 50 women from the downtown east side that went missing? No, they didn't mobilize. Because when it comes down to it, poor people don't matter. They don't count for votes. They don't count for taxes. They're a drain on the economy. And so if we're going to let it slide at home, you know, just like we're okay that people can find shelters and we're okay that people can find, you know, food, and then, but otherwise, don't be aggressive in your panhandling and irritate me. There's a kind of exclusion that is a mode of death. And I think it's not that far a step before we say, you know, our resources simply can't handle you anymore. So, you know, where are the trains to the gas chambers, you know? Like, really, where does this lead? And it's a very interesting book. A sociologist, Zygmunt Bauman, wrote Modernity and the Holocaust. And in describing that, he describes the ways in which in Nazi Germany, the Jews were kept in their own little ghettos, you know, not really allowed out. And they became more and more distant from people. And the rhetoric that would pass through the propaganda that these people were sort of become objects and sort of unwanted objects in the society. And these slow movements before everyone was okay with them being shipped off. So I think, you know, we're not, in allowing this to survive in our midst when it's face to face, we're saying, like, to a whole spectrum of people, you don't matter really to us. And I find that unacceptable. And okay, let's say not throwing money, but we're going to have to throw some money. And the problem is that for, you know, people who have absorbed the sort of narrative of upward mobility and accumulation and so on, that it's actually, we don't want to give any more to, you know, we don't want to give any more to poor people or whatever. So I find this kind of disturbing myself. But let's say it's not just money, but it is that. So homeless people need homes. Okay, let's build them homes. Let's build homes, build social housing. But maybe not stop there. Maybe we need to find ways to address the other issues like social inclusion, that we value their life and what they contribute to a society. Because mostly in our society, the only way you can meaningfully participate is by what we say having a job. Like, and if you don't have a job, it's such an embarrassment. It's so humiliating. You know, you feel like it's difficult. So how about if we widened our spectrum of like what it is to participate in society? And how do we create, let's say, social housing that is set within a framework of a community of acceptance and welcome and participation and so on? Now, yeah, we need to think about that. So there's a lot of those things we need to go after, as well as what you refer to as, you know, like stupid poverty. Certainly we need to deal with that too. But I think these things are kind of woven together. I mean, that'd be my hunch. And you know, there's a very interesting book written by this guy, I can't remember his name now, who he worked in the prisons in the States. He was from the States. It's called Violence: A National Epidemic. And he's a psychologist, and he worked with violent criminal offenders. And through all his study, he says, you know, the one common thing through all these guys who are serial killers and so on is that they experienced real humiliation in various points in their lives, just really being humiliated, being treated as if they didn't matter, they were insignificant. And no, not everyone who's treated that way, you know, like becomes a serial killer, but it's that when that seems to be a theme for across people, 25 years of working with this prison population. And in one of the chapters, he says, well, if you want to address at a national level, if you want to decrease violence at a national level, you have to decrease poverty. Because poverty is a source of massive humiliation in an affluent culture. And so I think that is as we see in this situation with the women from the Downtown East Side. Like in any other community, if one woman disappeared, there'd be a massive hunt. But in that community, poor, addicted, many of them Native women, sex trade workers. Who cares? These things become kind of thermometers. They become a little bit of a litmus test to say where the beat of the society really is. I find those things kind of fascinating, revealing in a way, and disturbing in that sense. Great questions, old man. Gosh.
Yep.